you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Actually, first, a tiny little correction. If I'm not mistaken, This American Life is at 1, not at noon. Le show is at noon. But in the meantime, you're stuck with me. And I'm excited about today's show. You read so many of these. I've been doing the show so long. You read all these books about, you know, how to get advice about how to improve your career or yourself. And they're all kind of redundant. Not this one. Robert Greene's the author of a book called Mastery, the previous book, very famous, and one of the books that a few books I've written all over, and although it came out about 12, 13, 15 years ago, it still sits prominently on my shelf, The 48 Laws of Power. He's also written The Art of Seduction, The 33 Strategies of War, The 50th Law, written with the most amazing, unexpected co-author, the rapper 50 Cent. But let me tell you about the book Mastery. It is something that examines the lives of great, both historical figures, like Charles Darwin and Mozart, but also a bunch of modern masters and everything from biomechanics to boxing. And he does distill the traits that made them masters. We all want to, deep down, we would like to be masters at something, experts at something. And he is here to help us be masters, or at least realize where we're unlikely to be. Robert Greene, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, good morning to you, Marty. Thank you for having me on your show.
My pleasure indeed. So let's start inductively with an example. Now, you've told many stories in the book. I found the story of an unlikely hero, Daniel Everett, particularly interesting. Tell me about him.
Yeah, I like the Daniel Everett because our idea of masters are these sort of geniuses who were born with all sorts of talent. And he comes from a background that you wouldn't think would lend itself to mastery. He grew up in Holtville, California, sort of a cowboy town near the border. Not an intellectual environment at all. His father was an alcoholic. He was basically raised by his mother. And as many young people growing up in the 60s, he got into drugs and had rock band and was just sort of a bit of a lost soul. And the only thing that he knew was he saw the movie My Fair Lady when he was in junior high, and he got kind of excited by the idea of studying languages. And he was very kind of, he had a gift for learning Spanish and other languages, but he had no idea what he would become in life. And a key moment was he met this girl in high school, became his girlfriend and his wife, and her family were Christian missionaries. And it was sort of like he decided overnight to not only marry her, but to convert and become a missionary himself and give his life some sort of direction. So he went to missionary school and became like a studied linguist. And the whole point of the program that he was in was that they go to all parts of the world teaching indigenous cultures the Bible. But in some places of the world, you have to learn extremely difficult languages in order to be able to translate into the Bible, because it hasn't been translated. And so they, because they saw in Daniel Everett pretty amazing basic skills with languages, they decided after training him to send him to the place where there was generally considered the hardest language in the world to master. It was an Amazonian tribe of some 300 people called the Pitahas. Completely isolated, and their language had nothing to do with any other language that they knew of, and they spoke no Portuguese. And people had been trying for decades to learn their language and translate the Bible, and nobody could do it. So they thought they would give Daniel Everett a try, and so they sent him and his family there. And basically, it was a real excruciating experience. He slowly had to get rid of all the preconceptions he had about their very primitive culture. He had to immerse himself in their way of thinking, which was very, very different from a Western way of thinking, obviously. And in immersing himself in their culture and kind of getting rid of all of his prejudices and the things that he had been taught to do, he begins to start cracking the code of Pitahaw, the language Pitahaw, and in the process of doing that, two things happen. He discovers that our concept of language is sort of postulated by Noam Chomsky has a hole in it, because Pita Ha doesn't fit into the paradigm. So we have to rethink our concept of languages. And the second thing happens to him is he decided that he no longer wants to be a Christian, basically because these people that he's with are so happy in their life and so tied to in their experiences, their immediate experiences, that he feels like Christianity would destroy them. And he becomes disillusioned, and he leaves the mission, and he becomes a great linguist, challenging our concepts of language. But it's a great story because he's not, you don't think of him as Einstein. He's 15 years old, long hair, doing drugs, lost soul, and he ends up becoming one of the most, you know, revolutionary thinkers in the field of linguistics. So that's sort of the Daniel Everett story.
So embedded in that are some other lessons. You know, one is certainly, you know, while he was not a polymath, a genius at everything, he had this one relative gift, which was the language thing, and he milked that. So that's one lesson, is find your, you know, we're never an overall genius. We may have some, you know, we may not be a genius at anything, but we're relatively good at something. So he went that route. The other thing is, despite being completely steeped in a Christian tradition, in order for him to focus and learn this completely alien, literally, language, he had to shed all of his pre-learned structures. And third, it takes a hell of a long time, and that you can even be a druggie and be successful.
I was a druggie, and I'm moderately successful. And the thing of it is that one of the concepts that I talk in the book is submissive learning, which is a linguistic concept, and basically he said the children of Pita Ha's learn the language, and if they can learn it, why can't I learn it? Well, children learn at an incredible rate because they're so open. They have no preconceptions. They're listening with everything they've got. They don't feel like they know anything. So he had to return himself to the position of a four-year-old. I don't know anything about this culture, these people, their language. I'm going to absorb it as if I were a child. And I make the point that in your apprenticeships in life, you need to be more like that. We come out of the university filled with all these things that we think we know and these theories, and we're no longer observing and watching the world around us. We're no longer that incredible sponge absorbing and observing. And it really is like I call it a learning disability. And so I want the reader in their apprenticeship to feel like you're actually literally going back to the position of being a child and submitting to the reality of this field that you don't know.
That's what the Buddhists call the beginner's mind.
Yes, exactly.
Right. You also, you know, we laughed about the drug thing. Your book actually, you know, especially, and this is particularly timely now, the public and especially the media is really pushing to legalize marijuana nationwide. You know, they make the argument that drugs make us more creative. I mean, and you talk about this guy having been a drug. You say yourself, you're Robert Greene, the author of the famous 48 Laws of Power and Mastery. You know, you were a druggie, and you talked about John Coltrane in the book, whom some people say did his most creative work while addicted to heroin. I mean, as you look at all the masters, you profile a lot of these masters in your book, and you're also quite a scholarly guy. You got a degree in classics. You've studied them all. To what extent do you think drugs help and hurt people's creativity?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, it's not black and white. As I said, I went to Berkeley in the 70s, so obviously I did a lot of drugs.
You are a cliche, sir.
I am completely a cliche. I even went to Grateful Dead concerts.
There you go.
And it didn't hurt me. The idea is that, in the book, is that we have wrong notions of creativity. Creativity isn't this incredible spark out of nowhere that comes to you from the heavens as if God's breathing into your ear and telling you this is a wonderful idea. Creativity is a function of hours upon hours of studying and understanding something and creating all of these connections in your brain between all sorts of different ideas, and then after that great rich foundation has been laid, it's like soil that's all rich with all these nutrients, then things, ideas will come to you out of nowhere, and you'll think that they're inspiration, but really the years of preparation led you there. And so you take someone like Coltrane, and he was addicted to heroin, and he realized it was destroying him. And in a very early, in a turning point in his career when he was with Miles Davis, he decided to quit heroin. And that's, after that is when he by far became infinitely more creative than those years when he was hooked on heroin. All of his great work came in the early 60s and onward after he had quit heroin. It is a complete myth that out of the old idea was that someone like Coleridge wrote an incredible poem coming out of a dream, perhaps inspired by smoking opium, etc. And it's since been proven that that's not the case, that really the writing of the poem, I'm sorry, the name is escaping me right now.
Rhyme, is it Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner?
I think that's it, yes. Was actually an extremely rational process. His notebooks revealed how hard he had worked on it. It's a myth because we don't want to believe that it really takes so much work to be creative. We want to think, oh, well, I could be like that. I could smoke some hash and write a great novel. It pleases our way of thinking, but it's just not how the brain works.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to buy the notion that both you stress in the book and Malcolm Gladwell said, an outlier takes 20,000 hours to become a master at something. Well, what do you say to somebody who's in midlife or later says they don't have 20,000 hours?
Well, it's not, if you're focused on the 20,000 hours or the 10,000 hours, you're never going to get there. You don't think that way. It's a process, and you have to enjoy the actual process. And sometimes, you know, it could take 10,000 hours, sometimes it could take 15,000 hours, whatever that adds up to, 10, 15, 20 years. But along the way, there are all these incredible rewards that you have. So I like to break it down into these phases so that you don't become suddenly overwhelmed. I mean, if you are in your 40s, and you want a career change, it's a lot realistic to think you're going to suddenly accumulate 20,000 hours. It's a little different. But there are still paths to mastery that we can discuss later. But I like to break it down. You have your apprenticeship, which is after you get out of university or education and you enter the real world. It's 7 to 10 years of immersing yourself in the field, learning the rules, learning how things operate, basic procedures that are in that lead to success. And then from there you enter a period where you start to experiment, become more personal and individual with your knowledge, entering a creative phase. And from there, if you take that far enough, you will enter mastery. But along the way, you have all these incredible little triumphs. You overcome your own laziness, your impatience. You build discipline and solid skills. You begin to play with the knowledge that you have and be creative, and that's an incredible reward. And that can happen even before the 10,000-hour mark. So there are these little benchmarks that you reach. The way the human being is designed, we don't do anything unless there's pleasure involved. If everything is painful, we'll never get there. We have to enjoy what we're doing. So the key to getting to the point of 10 or 20,000 hours is choosing a career that somehow meshes with something that you love. It doesn't mean that every hour that you spend in it is orgasmic and thrilling. That's ridiculous. But if you love writing like I do, and it's a challenge, then those days and months where it's kind of boring and you have to do research and figure things out, you can sustain them because overall you're excited by that challenge. So that's the key there, to not being intimidated by the concept of 20,000 hours.
You know, we all tend to roll our eyes at cliches, things that are said all the time. You know, you're saying about baby steps or enjoy the journey and in the process, but you know, damn it, it's right. Sometimes things become cliches because they are central. So dear listeners, please, in the end, you know, I am also somebody who is addicted to writing. I won't go into details, but I've written a lot. And you know what? Before I wrote my first book, all I could care about was, oh, I can't wait to get it done so I can see the cover and see the book in print. Yeah. You know what? Six books later, No, now it is all about the journey. It's about this paragraph, this sentence. Can I write this cleverly, intelligently, pithily? And it's all about the journey. So please, dear listeners, do not ignore Robert Greene's perhaps oft-said but nonetheless central tenets. By the way, you are listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Robert Greene. He's the author of the famous book, The 48 Laws of Power, and the almost as famous, but not quite, book Mastery. You know, let's go. You know, you talk about this need to, you know, be in the moment, but stay focused and enjoy the writing and find the niche and all. But, you know, the reality is, as you know, you wrote this, that all masters, people who are masters at something, have this internal force, an obsessiveness. And you give example after example of people who manifested that at a very early age, from Einstein to Ingmar Bergman, from Marie Curie to John Coltrane. Now, if you met an adult who lacked that internal force, could you do anything to help him? What would you actually do? I put a gun to your head. I said, Robert Greene, you've got to light a fire under his ass. You've got to give this person that internal force. What would Robert Greene do?
Well, I have done it. I've worked with people who come to me for consulting, and they said that, you know, they read the book, they like it, but they have absolutely no idea what their life's task is. I call in the book the sense of your life's task, what you were meant to accomplish in life, sort of to give it an overall goal or direction. And they'll come to me and they say, I just have no idea what that is. And I like to flip it around. There is something that an activity that if you found what it is, you will find that obsessive energy. You might be a lawyer, and it wasn't what you were meant to do, and you've been listening to your parents and other people tell you what you should be doing in life, and you're addicted to the paycheck, and money is all you think about, and now you have no idea who you are, what it is that you really, really love, what it is that clicks. And I try to tell people, if we can help you find it, if in fact you were really meant to be in music, I don't know, it's just an example, if that's what it is, and we get you there, that obsessiveness will come to you. You will want to work at it day and night, and it'll be like the great white whale in Moby Dick.
You know what? I'm going to interrupt you here. I'm going to push back on this one. I've been a career coach and career counselor to 4,400 people. And you know what? And I don't think I'm bad at what I do. And I think there are many, many, sure, it's really easy because there are some people for whom there is one thing they're excellent at and they're passionate about, and they're going to be the great video game designer or fashion designer or entrepreneur, or they care about Urdu languages or whatever the hell it is. But yeah. Most people, especially those who would come to somebody like you or me to try to help find their thing, the thing they were meant to do, there is no one thing that they were meant to do. And in fact, they're not going to be massively talented at anything. What do you do about the many, many people for whom there really is no one driving thing that is beneath the surface that only we dig deep enough will find it?
Well, first of all, I don't. It's a misconception to say I think it's one thing. And I have many examples in the book of a kind of a Da Vinci type characters who have a mind that's more restless, and that they end up mastering four or five or six different subjects and combining them in really interesting ways. I have an example of this woman who's a robotics engineer who just kept learning new fields because she was restless, and she goes into neuroscience.
Yeah, Yoko Matsui, or whatever her name is, yeah.
Yes. So it's a misconception that mastery is about just mastering one field, and in our day and age it's unrealistic to think that. But I do maintain that when children reveal a kind of an inclination, they have this concept of the five frames of intelligence, a really excellent book I recommend, where there are these different forms of intelligence. Some are mechanical, some are more visual, some are more literary, and people generally have a bent in their brain towards one of these. It can be two of them. It's generally not three, but there are hardly any examples of people who have zero. So you have a mathematical bent, a musical bent, a visual bent, and when you were a child, you were naturally drawn to certain things. Now, it's not going to be simple in the coaching and consulting I do where in 2 days we're going to discover that exact life's task. That's unrealistic. So I know what you're when you're saying when you push back on me. It can take several months of examining them, going back to what they may have missed in high school, how they got on the wrong path, how they started listening to other people. There are steps that I take with them to try and figure it out. And then it becomes a process of how do they take the experience they already have. They've spent 10, 15 years in law, and it's not what they want to do. It's not a question of abandoning all that you've learned. You have to take everything that you've got, all your experiences and your habits, and rechannel them in a new direction so that nothing that you've learned is wasted. So it's a path that's not simple. It's not like overnight, this is what you were meant to do. But I still maintain, and all kinds of great studies have borne this out, that everybody is born with this particular inclination towards different kinds of fields, activities, in forms of intelligence, and that it's drummed out of us by our parents, by the education system, by our peers, and it's a process of kind of rediscovering and reconnecting. I hope that doesn't sound too New Agey.
Well, I'm going to inject another dose of practicality here. There are many people whose passions are things that are passions held by many others. They do want to be a fashion designer. They do want to be the next Oprah. Or there's something that is completely so outside the zeitgeist of the era that it's unfundable. For example, I have a personal strong interest in the biological basis of something called G, which is the ability to reason abstractly, to remember a lot. It's what we, you know, it's more than intelligence, but it's certainly an important central component of intelligence. It is unfundable. The NIH will not fund it. The word intelligence is a dirty word today. So I, even though I have a PhD in a related field, it is my lifelong passion. I have zero chance of, it could be a hobby, and it is a hobby.
I'm going to push back on you. I don't believe that.
All right.
Because in the position that you're in, and you've written six books,
seven,
you have the power to write a book about it, and it's a fascinating.
I have written the books about it and articles, and it gets rejected immediately by the politically correct censors. It is not a topic that can be discussed. Period.
All right. Well, we can discuss this later.
Okay.
I would have strategies for how you can be indirect and eventually get that book out there. So I guess I'm not quite sure what your question is.
There are many people whose passions are either too widely held, and therefore you're not going to, you know, you could spend 20 years and spend a fortune, go to the Academy of Art College and learn about fashion design and be $150,000 in debt and still end up never making enough money even to pay back your student loans because too many people hold up, you know, have the same passion.
Passion. First of all, I'm a great believer in not going to school and not and burying yourself in debt, and I'm into practical learning and apprenticeships.
Right.
And if you have a choice of getting a low-level job at a fashion house in New York or going to fashion school, I would say 150 times out of 151, go take the regular job and learn from the ground up.
Amen. Amen.
Because you learn by doing. I started off in journalism, and thank God I never went to journalism.
Right.
School,
right.
And I got my first job in a magazine, and that's how I learned.
Right.
So that's number one where I would, you know, avoid that path.
Yep.
But, you know, it's not going to be a matter, it's never going to be easy. If it were easy, there would be 80 million masters out there, and we would all, you know, it would be paradise. We would all find exactly what we want and get paid for it. And there are fields that aren't so lucrative. So a lot of the times the masters that I talk about, let's distinguish, there's making millions of dollars and there's being a master. And some of the modern people I profiled aren't necessarily fabulously wealthy.
Good point.
So, you know, you're not going to be remunerated as much if you're a professor of neuroscience as someone who's on Wall Street. And I don't consider people who are brilliant at finance on Wall Street and playing all that alchemy with numbers to be masters, to be honest with you. So if your goal is making a lot of money, maybe this isn't the thing for you.
Fair enough.
I do think if you follow the path of mastery, eventually you will actually have make a lot of money.
It's a very good point. You talk about apprenticeship, and that's really, I mean, that is, if there was one of the major themes of this show, which has been on for 25 years, it is that the cost effectiveness and opportunity cost of learning in the old-fashioned apprenticeship one-on-one way, whether it be digitally or in person, is so much, the risk-reward ratio is so much better than getting a degree, especially now when getting a degree is seen as almost a basic requirement, so it's non-differentiating, and you're taught by these theoreticians. Couldn't agree more. So let's talk about apprenticeships. Now, what's one non-obvious key to finding the right master for your apprenticeship, your right mentor, or whatever?
Well, I say that the mentor is like a second parent. We don't get to choose the father or mother that we're born to, sometimes for better or worse. But we can choose this sort of second father or mother figure in our lives. And so you have to choose wisely. And a lot of mistakes people make is they go for somebody who's the most powerful, who makes the most money, who's got the biggest name, who seems the sexiest in the field. And that's not what you want to do. You want to find the right fit. Mm-hmm. You want to find somebody who you can say, I want to be doing their kind of work in 10 or 15 years. It's not, I want to have the attention they're having or the fame. I want to be doing something similar to what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And if I'm a bit of a rebel, which I personally am, I want to find a mentor who's unconventional. I don't want to find some straight-laced person who's going to make my life miserable and criticize everything I do. I want feedback, and I want someone to be realistic with me. But if the spirits don't match, it's going to really dampen my spirit. So you want to find somebody that's almost, there's an emotional attachment. People intellectualize these concepts way too much. Mastery is 95% emotion-based. Patience, persistence, tenacity, love of what you're doing. The mentor relationship is a very emotional one. It can get a little too emotional, and that can be a problem. But you want somebody that has that kind of fit. So there's my first non-obvious answer.
Love it. So let's make it real concrete. Let's say Robert Greene right now was did not have an august background as a writer at this point, but he knew that he wanted to make a living, not get rich, and I never implied that, you know, financial remunerative massive wealth was the goal, but you wanted to make a living being a writer, and you are now on the quest to find the spiritual soulmate, we're going to call the good fit master for your apprenticeship. How would Robert Greene, knowing what he knows now, but just starting out in terms of starting to try to get to the point where he can make a living as a writer and become a master, what would Robert Greene actually do?
You mean as far as finding a mentor or just in a career?
No, finding the mentor to help you go from...
It's interesting because I have it from the reverse side. I've had several people come to me searching me out as a mentor, and I have chosen a couple of them, one of whom has gone on to now be a very successful writer himself. And I choose people, which is something in the book and part of the advice I give, who I can see have, there's an emotional connection. For me, character is really important because there are a lot of people out there with very slippery characters who pretend to be something that they're not. So I look at that. I look at their work ethic, their discipline. Is there a good vibe between us? And then I want to see, do they have things that they can give me that I don't have? This particular guy who's gone on to become successful, his name is Ryan Holiday, had real knowledge of the internet, of things that I'm not very strong at. And so it worked out really well. So you reverse that. If you're the young person looking for, to become a writer and you want a mentor with somebody like myself, you have to think, you have to have something to offer. You can't just be, I want to be the next Ernest Hemingway. I know I can do it. Okay, I'm going to try and get, Robert to be my mentor. It won't work. You have to have something to offer. You have to already have some experience, something that will show me that you have organizational skills, research skills, etc. So before you go look for a mentor, get to the point where you're ready. There's an old proverb that says, when the pupil is ready, the master mm-hmm. will appear.
Mm, good, great. Make good, good sense, yeah.
You've got to have something 2 or 3 years, whatever it takes, before you actually make that, try and make that connection. Because in a realistic world, nobody will take you on unless there's a give and take where they can get something from you, you know? But the other side is, because I'm in that position, it's not as difficult as you might think to get somebody who's successful to be your mentor. There are a lot of successful people out there who need somebody who can help them, who can organize their life. So you don't need to be afraid of approaching these people, but you have to have something to offer them.
Makes great sense. So now, you said you've mentored a couple of writers yourself.
Yeah.
Let's think of all your experiences with them and come up with a moment when you felt was a particularly illustrative moment of what a good mentor does for his or her protege.
What I did for them?
Yes, one interaction you had with your protege that is exemplary of what a mentor, you know, what a mentor can do for a protege. What think of one interaction you had with one of your clients that was a signal that was important.
Well, I've only had two mentees. So you're talking about the mentees, not
yeah.
the clients.
Or whatever. Just that we're trying to come up with an example. I'm trying to keep things concrete. What's a moment you had where you felt you were transformative, if you will, of your protege, of your mentee, of
well,
your apprentice?
I guess I'll disagree a little bit. It's never really a moment, because one of the things I talk about, it can be, but for me, I talk about, I use in as a paradigm in the book, the story of the great scientist Michael Faraday, who mm-hmm. had this amazing mentor named Humphrey Davy, and over the course of years of working with him, he absorbed a very creative way of thinking and experimenting. Now, with my mentee, I have a particular way of researching books to find the material that I want, and he made mistake after mistake after mistake. The major mistakes that he kept making is he was too literal-minded. If I had an idea, a concept, for a chapter on the apprenticeship, he would take the word so literally and the idea, he wouldn't be able to be creative with it or think a little unconventionally. And it would drive me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, after, you know, months of pushing back and saying, no, that's not good, or ignoring his research, finally, he would turn up with something, a book or an idea that was right, and I would really praise him for it. And I said, okay, now you've got it. Now you've figured it out. And he's pretty much after that, he could do it on his own. So it wasn't like a moment where, you know, I could say and do something brilliant. It was more like he figured it out after kind of being around me a long time and me criticizing him, that on his own he understood how he had to think differently and think obliquely instead of directly about a subject. I don't know if that's too abstract.
No, it's great. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Robert Greene, the best-selling author of the classic book, The 48 Laws of Power, and more recently, the book Mastery. And now I want to turn, let you, my dear listeners, have a little access to the master. If you have a question or a comment for Robert Greene about the process of obtaining mastery, or you're even in your role as a master yourself, either as an individual or in apprenticing others, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before I even get out the phone number, the lines are lighting, so let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. Hi.
Hi, Marty. I'm Joel. Hold on a sec. I want to turn off my radio.
Okay, Joel. Very good. Yes. Sometime we hope that the phone screener person, although I don't have a screener. By those who don't know, this show, I do
Marty?
Not have a phone screener. I take them in the order received. True egalitarian, real radio, none of this primped up stuff. But I do also do like when the announcer does tell the person to turn down his radio. Anyway, we're still waiting for him.
Marty?
Yes.
I'm here back.
Good.
Hi. First, I want to say that I've been listening to you for years with great enjoyment and great benefit, and I want to compliment you very highly on, I've observed from in previous years your crudge-mudgeon, confrontational, sometimes a little cruel, and I'm delighted to see you have evolved into an older, kinder and gentler host, and I compliment you highly on that.
It depends on my guest. It really is. I like Robert Greene. I think he's smart. He's been giving excellent answers. I don't feel the need to interrupt him very much. I take pride on the fact of not being one-size-fits-all. If I have a guest who's not doing a good job, I'm going to be tough. Anyway, let's go. What's your question or comment for Robert?
Even when you're tough, you do it in a much kinder and gentler way than you did previously.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Greene and Marty, I love your topic. I'm 77 years old, and I'm thinking back on having gone through a very long and persistent process of finding what is finally my big passion in life, that I have a history of mild chronic depression, and for much of my life that kept me very discontent, uneasy in my skin and so forth, and I was continually seeking and questing. And finally, through a friend, I met a Burmese Buddhist monk, and on my first meeting and contact with him, I was just magnetically drawn to him, and I started spending lots of time with him and other monks. And over some years, I became a Buddhist, and that was largely because of the direct contact I had with monks who were living examples of the Buddhist teachings that I learned a lot about, and that tremendously changed my life. And through that, when I did a couple of 2-month meditation retreats in Burma, I observed that the monks who sometimes talked, these were for English speakers, the monks who talked to us were unintelligible, and from that I decided that my life's purpose was to become a coach of English pronunciation and listening improvement, and I've been working at that for some years and developing my own method on that, and that's my number one passion in life now, and I've chosen to do that because I believe that the more contact that Westerners can have with Buddhist monks and get learn about the Buddhist teachings, that the more it will improve their lives and the world and society in general. But what I want to emphasize is that my process has been a very long and persistent one, and what I've heard you and your guests saying about finding life's passion, it doesn't come from a handful of coaching sessions. The individual has to have that long-term seeking process.
I want to thank you for the call, lest we be guilty of going on too long ourselves. What was interesting particularly about the call is he had suffered from a lifetime of depression. To what extent does mental illness, you know, and you've studied dozens of these masters that you've written about in the book Mastery, to what extent is mental illness pervasive among masters, inhibitory, and how do they deal with it?
Well, I think particularly for artists, not so much for scientists, the creative process can be a little bit mimicking a manic depressive type state, where you have moments of incredible joy and power, where these ideas come to you, and then moments of intense frustration, where it seems to slip from your grasp, and then creating a book or a work of art and then the attention, and then there's no attention. It kind of creates those possibilities. And so what I've discovered for that kind of bent, and I have those tendencies, is that immersing yourself in the work is a form of therapy. Mm-hmm. That's why people become creative. If they're in their heads all day long, they would kill themselves.
Yep.
But by putting their hands literally or abstractly on the material, they enter what's known as a state of flow. A guy's name I can't even begin to pronounce.
Mikhail, that guy, right.
That guy, thank you. Wrote a book in the 70s about people who were so immersed in their work that they lose a sense of time itself, and he calls it flow.
Right.
And that's what will happen, you know, in music. And it happens in the sciences. And somebody like Darwin had a lot of attacks of depression, probably because of this illness, a physical illness that he had. It happens to scientists as well. But by immersing yourself in the work, you get out of yourself. And that's the thing I say, that you might think of pleasure as watching a movie at home or playing a video game, but the pleasure that you have in actually making something, a business or a book or whatever, is actually so much more satisfying in the end and so much more therapeutic.
I could not agree more. And a corollary of that is, not only does immersing yourself in the work free you from the navel-gazing of introspection, but also the external world to a master can be very depressing. What the preoccupation
particularly
this world. Right. The preoccupation with the trivial, the dishonesty, the rampant dishonesty in everybody from politicians to media people to everything. The hollowing out, I'm a career counselor, so the hollowing out of jobs from the middle class, which doesn't seem to likely have a replacement. My values, which are not consistent with the zeitgeist of the era, every time I turn on the TV I hear somebody saying something I disagree with. When you immerse yourself in the work, you are insulated from all of that as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, you don't want to get too isolated from your time. Right. There's a value to, you really can't. You're always a reflection of the time you grew up in. You don't want to get, Ted Kaczynski-like, but the therapy that you can, you get frustrated with the news and you just return to your work and it just you feel that pleasure of being engaged in the moment. I don't know how people can live without that.
Yeah, you talk in that context about Schopenhauer, who really was quite a hermit, and just decided he was just, if he put his hyper-rational intellectual brain onto any reality of the human being, he was dismissive. And while he didn't let himself have the luxury of being emotional about it, he had contempt for most people, most processes, most of the zeitgeist of the era, and so he did lock himself in his room, and perhaps maybe that contributed to his being iconoclastically brilliant. Do you agree or no?
Yeah. I mean, he was a weirdo. He had, for 40 some years, he had a routine that he did every single day, which is, writing a few hours, then playing some musical instrument, then having lunch at the same tavern, then taking a 2-mile walk, then going to his club, and then reading the newspaper, and then going to bed. And he did that every single day without ever deviating from it for so many years. I think that's a little bit strange. He's absolutely brilliant. The first Western thinker that connected to Buddhism itself and Eastern religions.
Right.
Very interesting man. We could talk 5 hours about Schopenhauer.
But let's talk a little about ritual. Carried to, an obsessive extent, perhaps it's not bad, but also I remember Einstein having a similar daily ritual. He would walk his 25 minutes each day from his place in Princeton to his office and back, and he always would walk. I have rituals that, I won't bore you with the details, but I certainly have a predominant ritual over how I spend each day, and I find it felicitous, both personally and actually facilitating of being productive. Do you have a ritual you'd follow every day?
Yeah, I'm a bit like that. I mean, I don't know how much I want to reveal publicly. They might lock me up. but I meditate in the morning. I've been doing Zen meditation now for so many years, and so I do that every morning. And then I, have my breakfast, and then I work for several hours, and then no more writing, and then I do my exercise, and I've got even like mini rituals and mini routines within the larger routines. Mm. I think it'd be dangerous for me to reveal too much of that.
Tell me about one of those that isn't too dangerous.
Well, let's see. You know, like I'll take a shower every morning, and I have 3 shampoos, and I rotate them, each one differently.
So do I.
Sort of
I have 2. Yeah.
To a mood. That has nothing to do with my creative process. That's why I said it looks like
yeah.
I'm insane.
And those are comforting. Those rituals, you know, in an intellectual life where everything is new and challenging and hard and not routine, having some of these kind of harmless little rituals in the shower or pre-bedtime rituals or, you know, exercise rituals or whatever, I think are necessary grounding to keep your life from being too chaotic, no?
Yeah, definitely. And the thing that I talk about in mastery, you know, if you're learning something, like when you were a kid, if you had to learn a musical instrument, a piano, which mm-hmm. is a common scenario, or let's say like chess mm-hmm. or sports, you kind of learn the pattern of learning itself, which is slow. It's a slow rhythm
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where at first things are intimidating, and then slowly you get better at it. And once you've internalized that, and it is a ritual, it is a slow ritual that can, at first is a little bit boring, it remains with you for the rest of your life, and you understand that now I'm older and I want to learn something. I can learn anything if I go through that process. So basically, what we're saying is rituals and process have a kind of a similar feel to them. And so that people who do a lot of learning and go through those processes maybe find banal rituals kind of comforting as sort of a mirror of that. But that, you know, in learning something, you have to reduce yourself to that level where you have to go slowly. There's no shortcut. There's no app you can get on your phone that's going to make you good at the piano. So, you know, maybe that's why people who are masters do tend to have these kind of silly rituals.
And, you know, coming back to the previous caller, you know, the emotional, you know, while maybe some level of depression is, you know, is a necessary, almost prerequisite to introspection and creativity and to productivity, you're in your book, you do talk about 6 emotional pitfalls that do invade in people. Complacency,
yeah.
Conservatism, dependency, impatience, grandiosity, and inflexibility. We don't have time to talk about all of them, but is there one that you think might be particularly interesting for us to chat about now?
Well, it's complacency. What I'm trying to say in the book is that I talk about original mind, conventional mind, and dimensional mind. So the original mind is what a child has. A child is what you call beginner's mind.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely open to the world. They absorb things. They learn. They're curious. They're insanely curious about the world. And then what happens is we get older, as we get drummed into us all these conventions and ways of thinking and these patterns that are so deadening, and we lose touch with the original mind, and we become complacent. We think we know everything we need to know. How many people do you know in a conversation will admit that they were wrong or that they don't know an answer?
Very few.
No,
especially here in the Bay Area, where we have this feeling that we have a monopoly on wisdom.
Yeah, everybody knows everything, and the moment somebody admits that they were wrong, you know, hell will freeze over. And it's a great detriment to being creative. And I talk in the book, I know we're running out of time, but of the concept of negative capability from the poet John Keats. And it's a childlike ability to not know the answer, to be uncertain, but to be kind of wowed by mysteries. And I'm saying that people like Einstein, who said the worst thing that can happen to a mind is to get complacent, to lose that childlike wonder, that you can become successful and creative, but then it's you hit a wall because you've come to that point where you think, I'm just so fucking brilliant, I just know all the answers, and then the learning stops, and you know your great work happened once when you're in your 20s, but after that, nothing else comes from you. So complacency, I think, is the absolute worst deadly sin that can happen to you later in your career.
You mentioned you worry about us running out of time. You're such a good guest. I'm going to have you back if you're interested, so we don't have to rush. Take your time. Give the answers you think are right. No, not a problem. But we're not allowed to use the F word because of the stupid FCC, which is ridiculous, but that's the rule. So we apologize to anybody who is offended by that word that we've all used 10 million times. But
sorry about that.
That's all right. Let's go.
George Carlin moment.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Robert Green. What is your question or comment for him?
Hi, Marty. I recently turned 60, and concurrent with that, there was a reorg at my company, and I was laid off among other people. My question is this. Since I've been laid off, I've been taking some courses, improving some of my skills. I'm about to attend a workshop in the UK, which is going to cost me a lot of money, but I'm thinking if I do it, it might be beneficial. Tagging on what Mr. Green just said, I constantly learn. I mean, I love learning. So that part isn't an issue, but I'm wondering about the law of diminishing returns. Like I said, I'm 60. Am I being foolish to think that I can, someone will hire me, basically?
Robert, your thoughts?
Well, it's hard to, I would want to spend several hours with you. It's not foolish at all, but the main thing is you want to take your experience for 30 years or whatever it was in a particular field, and you don't want to throw it to the wayside. You want to build on all of these incredible skills that you have, but you want to maybe channel it in a new direction. I don't know what that is. The main problem that people have is their skills are totally redundant. And so you reach the point where you're 60 and you're getting paid well, and they decide to replace you. I don't know if that's the scenario. But there are people younger and cheaper who can do what you have. And you've got to find a way to position now that you're 60 where what you have to offer a firm or as an entrepreneur or whatever is not redundant. It builds on all of your incredible rich experience, but now you're going to take something peculiar to yourself, unique about your way of thinking, things that you've learned that nobody else is thinking, and now you're going to apply it to something different that will differentiate you from the hundreds of other people who are, unfortunately, in your position. That's the key to the game. As far as that course in the UK, one or two ways. You can get seduced into thinking an expensive program, it's like El Dorado, this will transform me. I don't know if that's it. On a very practical level where you really, it's a good, solid investment of your money and time, and hopefully it's not some sort of a dream or things that you haven't thought through enough.
Colin, I want to add something here to the equation. People who say they love learning and they keep going and you're wondering whether they're reaching a point of diminishing returns, that says something to me, I'm inferring, given the little time we have, but I'm inferring that you are one of those learning addicts and you keep wanting to learn because it's fun, even without regard to the utility. Yet you're saying you're worried about your hireability. In the limited time, when you're 60, we do have to be aware. We have a certain number of heartbeats in our life, and as we're 60, they're becoming, we're becoming ever more aware. There's fewer and fewer. To ask yourself the hard question, is this the optimal use of your time, and especially in this case your money, given that you're worried about getting hired? I would rather see you inventory, as Robert said, I'd rather have you see you inventory what you bring to the table. And then say to yourself, how could I package this and maybe a little bit of just-in-time learning so that I could make a value proposition to a business, a nonprofit, a government agency that would make me more desirable, as Robert said, than the 23-year-old who is going to have more energy, more currency, although not the wisdom. So I wish you the best with that. We do now have just a few minutes left, so I want to just ask you one more question for the moment. We're going to what I plan to do is invite you back to talk about some of the principles that are in your book that are also tied in with your book, The 48 Laws of Power. So, for example, issues around the criticality of seeing people as they are, beneath the smiling veneer, what you should be aware of, maybe more how you've used the book, The 48 Laws of Power, in your own life. But for now, just a couple of points about the book, Mastery, that we haven't gotten. You stress that masters emphasize the details. For example, you point to Da Vinci. Yet many people pridefully describe themselves as big picture people. Would you try to convert them, and if so, how?
Well, it depends on who you are. If you're 24, 25, and you think you're a big picture thinker, I'd be a little bit worried. The problem that we have is the brain with our brains is that because of language, language is very abstract and conventional, that we're already thinking in terms of larger pictures. We're already doing the sort of shorthand with reality, with concepts and words for things, so that we're no longer observing. We have the word tree, but we no longer see how each tree is actually very, very different. So language itself prevents us from seeing the details in the world around us. And I want people, when they're young, in their 20s, when they're in their apprenticeship, to be consummate observers. I want them to soak up about the social situation, which is an element we haven't gotten into a book. I have a chapter on social intelligence because we are social animals, and you can't divorce our ability to get along with people to our ability to master a subject. I want you to look at people, see each individual as they are, see what makes them tick, what makes them different from everybody else. I want you to look at your field and look at the details and what makes something run and the kind of things that most people just don't notice. There are too many big thinkers out there and not enough people who are detail-oriented. And it's a fault getting worse by the day in our cyber culture.
Yep, absolutely.
Where people are not connected to reality. They're also virtual. And you see it in how hotels are designed without any attention to the detail, as if somebody dreamt them up on a computer screen but didn't figure out how the human hand has to actually turn a faucet on and off. I want people who are going to be masters to be infinitely more detail-oriented. The big picture thinking will come to you 20,000 hours later. Okay, so that's
couldn't agree more. We only have a few seconds left, but I want to take one. Just give me a quick 30-second answer to this. I was very struck, and I'm not a visual person. I'm an auditory person. I'm a writer. I'm a speaker. I'm not visuals, and yet, you know, I don't want to. Very interesting in your book is that a lot of the people who were masters used visuals. For example, diagrams and pictures. Tell us, just make some brief comment about the importance of using visuals in becoming a master.
Well, a visual is an old form of human intelligence before we had language, and it can be very powerful because in an image you can capture a feeling that words just can't do. So, for instance, Darwin, early in his career, he wasn't a particularly visual person, but he had this idea of the tree of life and that this was evolution. Everything sprung from one seed, the tree emerged, and then there were branches, and the branches are all of the different forms of life that came out of that. And he stuck with that image his whole life. It just captured exactly the essence of his theory of evolution and natural selection. Freud had the idea of the unconscious being this iceberg that is submerged under the ocean. And he found that incredibly interesting way of relating to the unconscious when words weren't quite capturing it. When I had my book Mastery, I thought of intelligence that I was describing as a kind of a house with a basement and rooms that you are in, slowly getting up more and more to where there's light coming in higher, the higher up you reach. And it actually, I never put it in the book, but it actually helped me conceptualize all this material I was putting together. So thinking in terms of an image is a really powerful, primitive way of doing something that words can't capture. It's a lot richer than words in so many ways.
And you thank you so much, Robert Greene, for adding a little light to all of our houses. And the book is Mastery. And I do hope you will come back because you were a great guest. Absolutely. The author of the book is Mastery. I absolutely commend it to you. It's a rich, rich book, as well as his classic book, The 48 Laws of Power. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Eric Wayne, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers, and I will discuss with my wife Brian Tracy's latest of his, get this, 500th book, the book Time Management. A guy who wrote 500 books, he's obviously good at time management. So until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you can also email him, and if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program, his site, martynemco.com. That's Marty, NEMKO.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco, right here on your local public radio, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco.